Our next speaker is David Larrabee. And he's speaking on eschatological visions and climate change decisions. David is a retired physics professor from East Stroudsburg University in Pennsylvania, as well as a graduate of Union Theological Seminary in New York City. Pull up your slides here. Okay, are you going to recognize your thing faster than
high
I
desert
will?
On the front.
Are we up and slideshow from beginning ought to work?
And is there a clicker?
You can see if that works. The little extension thingy is in place. I think
there's nothing on the screen.
Okay, hang on.
Computer, there you go.
Duplicate. We'll pop this in. That should have been it.
Yeah, got it.
We've got it. Okay. Okay, well, we can just get rid of that.
Go to slideshow from
and
beginning.
From beginning.
There we go.
Voila.
Good afternoon. Thank you for being here. Dinner is a short time away. I'll try to be relatively brief. The basic cause of climate change is simple enough. Human beings are putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, and we are destroying natural sinks of greenhouse gases. The solution is also clear. Stop emitting greenhouse gases and stop destroying natural sinks. Doing nothing about climate change is an environmental disaster. Eliminating fossil fuels without replacing them with other forms of energy is an economic disaster. The time required for the transition is limited to perhaps 35 years if we are to avoid a 2-degree C temperature rise. Climate change is an ethical and moral issue with economic, technological, and lifestyle implications. The decisions we make today will profoundly affect the world my grandchild will inherit. I believe that we are spending too much time talking about the kind of world we are trying to avoid and not enough time talking about what kind of world we are trying to create. This is the unavoidable consequence of an apocalyptic vision of the future, a vision dominated by fear. Future visions drive current decisions. This paper will address relationships between ethics, our future visions, our relationship to nature, and a little bit to scripture. There we go. The Greek eschatos refers to a last in a series, sequence, or end of a process. Such a process need not occur at the end of time, but rather the end of an era, say the era of fossil fuel usage. Some visions are dismissed as pure fantasy, others as unrealistic, and some as utopian dreams. But visions can motivate future decisions. It is this link between vision and motivation that makes a particular vision eschatological, as I am using the term. Always had trouble pronouncing that. As secular eschatological vision with discipline points to a faith in that discipline, taking on the character of a religion. Apocalyptic or dystopian vision leads to decisions based on fear. Rarely do decisions based on fear turn out well. A utopian vision of the future, that everything will turn out okay regardless of what we do, can lead to a detachment from the world we inhabit, leading to decisions that do not consider the needs of the present. A vision of the future that could be allows us to see opportunities in a crisis. As Moltmann puts it, to perceive the chances in the crisis. Different visions place their faith in different human institutions. Consider the carbon pollution caused by automobiles. Faith in technology would create green cars with green fuel. Faith in economics suggests a carbon tax. Faith in politics outlaws them. Faith in individual lifestyles promotes the use of public transportation. These differences prevent a consensus on how to proceed. Before we can begin to formulate a vision of the future that is neither apocalyptic nor based on an unrealistic utopian ideal, we need to recognize that we already have at least an implicit eschatological vision. Oops, Okay. Economic, technical, political, and ecological future visions can all present a secular eschatology that can motivate and influence climate change decisions. Our economic status largely determines the material lifestyle we can afford, the wealth we can afford, our status in society, and our security in a changing world. Robert Nelson has made a career of asking if economics is a religion. His unequivocal answer is that economics is a secular religion and is currently being attacked by another secular religion, environmentalism. According to Nelson, the vision of economic religion is that human beings can produce an ideal world, or heaven on earth, by ending the material poverty through productivity, efficiency, and scientific management. The unspoken assumption in climate change politics is that the developed world will not lower its material lifestyle. Rather, that the material lifestyle of everyone else should rise to the level enjoyed by the upper middle class of the United States. The United States has sold this eschatological vision to most of the developed and developing world. Okay. Technology brings many wonderful things to fruition. New medical advances, improved transportation and communication, and the newest gadgets that find their way into our lives. But technology plays another important role, supporting the economic system that demands ever-increasing growth. It is technology that provides the alternatives to fossil fuels. It is technology that will be tasked with finding solutions to the limited resources that threaten long-term unlimited growth. The economic system, and to a large extent the public, has put their faith in the technological vision that there will always be solutions. Garrett Hardin summarized two important aspects of the public's technological vision. The first he calls a dogma of Aladdin's lamp. If we can dream it, we can invent it. And the second is the dogma of the technological imperative. When we invent it, we are required to use it. Gerhard Hardin's dogma of Aladdin's lamp runs rampant in today's science fiction movies. Examples range from warp drive technology through magical future energy sources that will provide us with all the energy we could ever use. There is no support for the dogma of Aladdin's lamp within the currently known scientific corpus. Miracle cures for climate change are routinely paraded in social media, often exaggerating the claims of researchers working on real problems. I'm not suggesting the research stop. Many such ideas merit development, but the timescale suggests that the solutions we employ will largely be those available to us today, perhaps with improvements. The technological vision of a high technology future implemented in time to save us from fossil fuels without any pain is no more likely than Aladdin's lamp. The argument that a certain technology should be employed implies a prioritization of values, and consequently a vision of how the future ought to be. Technological solutions are constrained by resource limitations. Hardin's dogma of the technological imperative also rings true today. If it's technologically possible without any immediate apparent risk, why not pursue it? Without a centralized worldwide agency to determine what is moral, the pursuit of all available technological solutions seems unavoidable. In a world where individual freedom is a primary value and all ethics is reduced to personal ethics, this is a problem that is likely to remain. Politics and eschatology are intimately linked in the Hebrew Bible as well as the New Testament. The secularization of eschatology saw freedom as a historical goal, not only in Marxist ideology, but in the ideology of Western liberal thought as well. The social and personal implications of combating climate change will impact personal freedoms. For just one example, the freedom to own and drive a car powered by fossil fuels will have to be curtailed. A conflict of possible future visions. Political activism is seen as a way of addressing many issues within our society, racism, sexual norms, climate change, as well as political representation. Trying to push a society in the direction the activist feels is better is an implied future vision of how the world ought to be, and it's a motivating decision. We live in a world that creates individualized secular eschatologies. Recently, New York Magazine published a worst-case scenario called the uninhabitable Earth. Consequently, there's been a discussion about the wisdom of only talking about apocalyptic visions. What is missing is a shared positive eschatological vision. It is easier to agree on the consequences of not addressing climate change than to come up with a future vision that both addresses the major global issues and is acceptable to other eschatological visions. How much wilderness should be saved? As economic growth is to be limited, will the developing countries share their wealth with the undeveloped countries? Whose population growth is most detrimental to the environment? Are some species more important than others? The questions are endless. Continued economic growth that brings the projected 9 to 10 billion people on the planet up to the material standard of living available to the average US population is almost certainly not feasible, even with advanced technology. The likely result is that a global peaceful solution seems unlikely, as the haves seem unlikely to share with the have-nots. The eschatological vision of preserving wilderness and creating a sustainable future are threatened by the demands of distributed justice. The solutions for climate change are likely to threaten our individual freedoms, which lies at the very heart of United States political ideology. These visions are in conflict with each other. Nope. There are three basic climate change issues that all such eschatologies, religious or secular, need to make explicit. The role of material wealth, our relationships to each other, and our relationships to the rest of creation. Religious eschatologies need to include our relationship to God and how that impacts the other three items. I would like to go into some detail about our relationship to the rest of creation and leave the other points for another day. Much of the theological discussion about environmental ethics is focused on the relationship between humans, the rest of creation, and God. There are many different theological opinions. Of the many different opinions out there, several stand out. Dominion, stewardship, a broken relationship needed reconciliation, and a divine vocation to serve creation. These four views have different interpretations of the cosmology in Genesis. Briefly, cosmology is not the same as eschatology, but the relationships between humans and creation in cosmology influence how our eschatological visions show up, and that's what I'll be talking about. The chain of being has its origins in antiquity, but found formal expression by the Greek philosopher Plotinus in the 3rd century AD, and still influences our thought to this day. Human beings are clearly given permission to subdue the surface of the land in Genesis 1:28. Perhaps for the purpose of agriculture. The dominion over animals has been variously interpreted over the years, but before Thomas Bacon in the 17th century, dominion was largely seen as making use of the environment, what science now calls eco-services. Humans could protect themselves against wild animals, raise cattle, create cities, etc. Bacon advocated that human beings investigate nature and use her secrets to dominate and subjugate nature for human benefit. Bacon started the process of stripping away any intrinsic value from nature, leaving only the instrumental value to human beings. Dominion shows up in eschatology when the relationship to the earth is determined by its instrumental values without regard to any intrinsic value. Forests are useful and valued for recreation, leisure, and pleasure, not because they have any intrinsic value apart from the human beings or other elements within creation. The stewardship of creation is a concept that is used to interpret biblical passages dealing with the relationship to creation. It was introduced at the time of Bacon by Matthew Hale, in an effort to soften the dominion mandate of Bacon. The image of a steward as a manager of resources brings to mind the image of an absentee feudal landlord, hardly the biblical relationship between God and creation. It suggests a view that creation benefits from human management. A stewardship model of the relationship between humans and the rest of creation implies that fallen human beings are capable of successfully managing creation. Not even Adam was given this mandate. Stewardship softens the dominion of Genesis 1 by asserting that a good king does God's will. To what extent is stewardship just dominion with an enlightened self-interest? Too often, stewardship becomes the management of nature for human benefit. Stewardship can show up in eschatological thought much in the same way as dominion. It's not surprising that stewardship shows up in sort of the scientific management nature context today. Reconciliation ecology, not to be confused with restoration ecology, attempts to find ways that transform the spaces that people dominate so that other species can occupy the same area. Reconciliation ecology is the science of inventing, establishing, and maintaining new habitats to conserve species diversity in places where people work, live, and play. David Warners et al. Have articulated a theological paradigm that builds on this ecological discipline. Acknowledging that humans are part of creation, they move the position of humans from above creation to besides creation. I've simplified their diagram a little bit here. All the relations in the diagram are seen as broken and therefore in need of reconciliation and redemption. There is too much wealth in the article to cover here, so I encourage you to read the article yourself. It's in the December 2014 issue of Perspectives. Although an improvement over the stewardship model, there are several weaknesses of the reconciliation model. Humans are still represented in this model as separate from creation. Reconciliation can only proceed when the wrong party, rest of creation in this case, offers forgiveness and the offender works towards restoring a correct relationship. Within the reconciliation model, the new relationship is not a restored relationship, but a modified relationship which is determined by human beings. Finally, as mentioned by the authors, the original mandate given to Adam in the garden can be interpreted as a divine vocation to serve and protect the garden. The reconciled relationship is one of hospitality to other creatures, to share in a human-dominated space, but not one of restoration. How does reconciliation ecology show up in an eschatological vision? So I'll quote from the article. Furthermore, being the only creatures to have been created in God's image, humans are called into a special responsibility of nurturing and encouraging creation's flourishing. Later on the same page, green spaces and campus gardens can provide habitat for humans and native creatures alike. In such effort, these places can become potent demonstration sites for sustainable landscaping, sustainable food generation, purchasing, consumption, waste processing, and carbon neutrality initiatives. All important things, but these are all human activities. Is such a vision applicable beyond spaces dominated by human activity? Granted, most of the earth is becoming dominated by human activity, pushing creation to the sidelines. But is that a desirable state of affairs? I believe we need to go one step further. First, we need to locate human beings within creation, seeing ourselves as having duties and obligations to the rest of creation. The Bible doesn't define what it means by imago Dei, so all definitions are the interpretation of the text. The use of imago Deo to put humans outside of creation is not faithful to the majority of the biblical texts. Although in my talks, that often comes up. Indigenous people have a very different relationship to nature than do those of us living in the developed countries. The temptation to treat all people as if they had the same relationship to creation should be avoided. This also includes people within a less developed country. Within our country, the homeless person in New York City has a very different relationship with creation than the billionaire who owns their own airplane and yacht. Part of Jesus' mission was as the servant king. And he asked his disciples, quote, "Whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave." And I think we can use Jesus' life as a way of understanding what's meant by imago Dei. Perhaps we're called to serve not just people, but all of creation. One interpretation of the Hebrew in Genesis 2:15 is that Adam is called to serve and protect the garden. In some science fiction films, cities are isolated areas surrounded by wilderness. Perhaps this is one model for creation care. It is very different than the sprawling suburbs of the United States. Thinking eschatologically means thinking about the world we are trying to create, rather than just the world we are trying to avoid. This is from Moltmann. An ethics of fear sees the crisis. An ethics of hope perceives the chances in the crisis. In the exuberance of hope, the temptation is utopianism. In fear, the temptation is alarmism. Crisis brings about the necessity of change. It is possible to look towards one's eschatological vision, examine the present condition, and see possibilities that bring the world closer to how it ought to be. In Moltmann's words, to see the chances in the crisis. Such an ethics requires a vision of what the future should look like. A future vision, a secular or religious eschatology. It is only when eschatological visions are explicitly expressed that transformation from what is to what should be can be evaluated. When we understand our own visions well enough, we can share them with others who have a different vision. Coming to a consensus on climate change requires that all parties in the discussion develop a clear eschatological vision which is honestly put on the table. Once these visions are thought out and on the table, they can be evaluated for their effectiveness in achieving the stated goals. Hopefully, a dialogue of visions will allow us to forge a path that strives for consent. It is not the ideal vision that needs to be found. That may indeed be a fool's errand. Rather, we need to find a vision to which we can all consent as the best we could hope for, given the situation. When you're having the discussion, everyone needs to be at the table, and nature needs to be at the table as well. Climate change is an ethical and moral issue that challenges the developed world's material consumption. All climate change decisions are moral decisions with an implied eschatology. The invitation is to look within our hearts, within our religious traditions, and within our activism to make the implicit visions explicit. And then, and only then, can we subject our visions to both moral scrutiny and technical analysis. Can we live to learn in harmony with all of creation, taking our rightful place as a creature, rather than viewing ourselves as demigods above the rest of creation? Thank you. I've asked for some references, so there are some references that may be useful.
Okay, great. Thank you, David.
Questions?
Comments, questions?
Yeah, well, you commented one very small point on less developed peoples. If you think back historically to the Middle Ages, the Earth was considered to be the center of the universe. We've now moved in the US, and I speak as an American citizen, that we, and particularly Americans, are, in some sense, the center of our universe. We have rampant individualism.
Absolutely, yeah.
If you compare our view as Americans, for most people, with that of the collective view of the rice-growing peoples of Asia, who have a history of 5,000 years, and a lot more harmony with nature than we have. I think we've got a lot to learn from these other views, and I'd be interested in your thoughts.
Hopefully I'll get this close to what you're saying. I think the essence of your question is that there are other cultures that have a closer relationship to the environment and a history of that, whereas Americans, hey, the automobile is our symbol, the personal freedom, I can do whatever I want to as long as it's legal kind of attitude. I agree with you. It is not surprising to me that some of the leaders in environmental Christian ethics are in dialogue with indigenous peoples. The indigenous peoples have been silenced during the climate change in Paris, yet there have been numerous statements put together by indigenous people critiquing the West, and they deserve to be listened at. And so if it was longer, we could present some of them. But yeah, you're absolutely right. And we have a lot of learning to do, which is something that typically Americans don't do well.
Other questions or comments?
I really appreciate your vision. It lays out a framework for it to go forward. But how do you handle, within your vision, the developing countries? Since fossil fuels present after food and shelter, they present the next need of a developing economy, and fossil fuels present the efficient way to get there. I mean, I see the breaks that you're talking about in the U.S. model that we've sold to the rest of the world, but how do we deal with those developing societies?
That's a great question, and something we could talk about for about an hour easily. I'll make the following comment. You're right in the sense that the reason we develop through fossil fuels is they're fairly easy. The danger of bringing advanced non-fossil fuel technologies to a less developed country is that all we'll do is take an economic imperialism and replace it with a technological imperialism. That is, if you bring large technical plants into a country that does not have the ability to maintain, service them, their access roads, then they need help, we'll sell it to them, and we've just enslaved them. It's colonialism and imperialism in a new guise. The answer I would like to save is, as this morning's presenter, is that the U.S. has to back off its energy use. And the indigenous people will say, the critique of us is we need to make space in the environment for them to go through this process. And ideally that would, I'm not thinking that's going to happen, but ideally that's what would happen. As we as Christians, I think the danger is that we see ourselves as Americans and then Christians. And the Christian church was not born as a dominant. It was born by an oppressed people, an oppressed time, critiquing Rome. And I think it's time that we take that role seriously and say, I'm not a Republican, I'm not a Democrat, I'm not a this or I'm that, I'm Christian. And I will critique the society we live in from the Gospels. So I'm not optimistic, but...
Other comments, questions? All right, let us thank David for his...